September 8th, 1979, talking to John Honey and Lorraine at their fish camp at Big Eddie.
Slow process in the whole thing, you know. They worked pretty hard, though.
Yeah, they worked pretty hard. Mm-hmm.
36 when we got married.
Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe you could talk about what happened after that, like when you, right after you got married, what you two did.
Well, right after I got married, I was working in the mines when I got married, and I worked about a year in the mines after I was married, and then I quit in the fall, and we both got a gas boat from my uncle. His name was Deef Mike. He loaned us the boat, 14 horsepower, Red Wing inboard motor, and we went up the Novi for the fall, got our outfit from Tom Devane's store, and about $600 outfit. Why, it was a big pile of grub in those days. We had all the grub we wanted. About 10 cases of gas. And we went way up the Novi to Moose Mountain. Then we spent the fall and trapped there all the winter. And we stayed up there in the spring, then came down after breakup in the boat. Hunt muskrats, and didn't hunt very many muskrats. Didn't get very many, but we hunt some muskrats. There wasn't many muskrats up that way then. Came down in the spring, then we went fishing, I believe, over here, about 20 miles above Ruby's. My wife's grandmother owned a camp, and they practically turned the place over to us, and the place was ours ever since. And so it belongs to my daughter now. She have a land allotment on there. Her auntie have a land allotment on there, and it's approved of, so I believe she'll get it, and everything is willed over to her. So I believe she'll own that land allotment. And then after that, why, we fished all summer, and then we've been going up the Novi every fall. We bought our own boat then. Went up the Novi every fall for the winter to trap up there.
When you and Lorraine were out, would like when you're hunting muskrat or whatever you're hunting, do both of you hunt the same kind of things? Or?
Oh, yes. We hunt together. A lot of times, both of us in one canoe. I make my own canoe out of canvas canoe, and we cross the Novi River amongst some little ice running in one canoe, flimsy little canoe. I never would think of doing that now. Can't even paddle across the river in a canoe by myself. Unless it's a pretty big canoe.
So with both of you hunting, would you do pretty well for the winter, and you know?
Oh yes, we trap together. We both work together every way and agreed with everything we'd done. So that way along in life, it was very easy for us. Sometimes we had a pretty tough times during the winter there when we had to run out of pretty short on grub and dog feed also when the cold weather came, when we couldn't come in. It was so far out there, we didn't know any better, I guess. We went up so darn far up the Novi, there was a long ways to come in overland to break trail, and we didn't know where the winter trail was till we came into where the other trappers were, and we hit their trail and come in. For the first couple of years, we had a pretty rough go of it, you know. But we always had plenty of grub and everything, and we enjoyed everything we was doing, no matter cold weather or any kind of weather.
What kind of place were you staying in at Trapline?
Well, when we got up there in the fall, we built our own cabins. Now, that's since 1937. I think I built 4 cabins up there.
More than that,
I think. 2 one place. Five cabins. Five different cabins I have built up there. Different places.
In Novi, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd go in the fall time?
In September. We always leave here. Once we left here pretty late, was about 20th of September, I think. That's the latest. We always generally leave about the 15th of September, going up for the fall. And then we'd have to spend along the way. The water was low, and we'd have to camp for a couple of days till it rained or something, the water raised, so we can go over the riffles. Pretty shallow in places away up the river.
Like hard work just to get there.
Yeah, but we didn't mind it. The weather warm, and when we had to lay over, we were hunting, and once we get a moose, why, we were all right. We were just fine. We had plenty of meat on the boat, all our grub and everything. Why? We never had no fish nets to put in till way later on. When we got a little older, we have fooled around with fish nets. Set in the fall time for a while, just to fool around with.
You'd set them in the Novi?
Yes. We look for eddies. Come in. We look for eddies and find some places and catch whitefish, pikes. I don't think we ever got any sheafish up that way.
We did.
Oh, yeah?
There's some way there.
Yeah.
So would it be cold enough that you could just use that for dog food, too?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We put them up on the cache. We had fish nets late in the fall time, you know. We just have to take the nets out when the ice began to run. And the ice always run in the Novi every fall, you can figure about the 5th of October. And on the Yukon here, we figure always around the 9th of October.
9th or 10th.
Mm-hmm.
So those fish nets you would have up there, would that be those linen fish nets?
Mm-hmm.
Homemade nets.
Yeah.
Yes, white fish nets.
On those days.
So those be nets that Lorraine made?
Yes, she made our own nets up till a few years ago. We started getting these nylon nets and the floaters on them and everything. Plastic and new kind of sinker line on them and everything. We made our own sinkers out of rocks and stuff like that.
What kind of?
Made floaters out of dry cottonwood bark.
You carved those up?
Carved them out like a, some kind of a shape like.
Look, just long and kind of sharp on both ends.
About a foot long. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I make them short and fat.
They're about as big as bananas. Yeah.
Shape of a banana, yeah.
Then we'll go along the beach and look for certain kind of rocks.
Yeah, the oblong rocks.
Yeah.
And then we sew some canvas over it and then attach it to the bottom fishnet. It's for the sinkers.
That would take a while to make a net. Huh?
It does, yeah.
How big would you make nets then?
Huh?
How long would you make your nets then?
Oh, sometimes I make it 40 feet long. Most is 30.
Yeah, about 30 feet, I think.
Mm-hmm. 30 or 40.
They measure, when they make nets, they measure them by the length of their arms, and they never use tape measure.
Is that the kind of measuring people would do for all kinds of sewing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a yard right here for me. Right here to the tip of my fingers.
Oh, from your shoulder?
Mm-hmm. Right here to my arm. It's a yard for me.
Her grandma used to put her arm out like this and go like this or something.
Oh,
and she said, that's 3 feet. I'd get a tape measure and go over there and I measured and it's exactly 3 feet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good. You don't have to carry anything extra around either.
No. Then, 1937, at that time in... I had a pretty rough time. We had to make our own snowshoes, and I never made snowshoes before. And I made a couple of pair. And...
Not 1937, Dad.
Well...
That was 1945.
I made the first snowshoes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. After I made the second pair, why, it was all right.
What happened to the first pair? What was that?
Well,
like?
It was pretty hard to make snowshoes and when there's no one around to show me how, and drilling the holes and getting the right kind of birch and everything, but... I made snowshoes good enough to walk in. They were a little flimsy or really not fancy like some people make them, you know. I just bent them without a form and might have been a little out of shape like some other snowshoes. And then my wife filled them.
I had a time.
Yeah.
Mom, I stay up all night till 1 o'clock in the morning try to finish them.
Yeah, we
go so far and then I have to unravel them. That was work. Till my fingers got sore.
We cut our own rawhide.
Mm-hmm. Rubbish.
We used to sit up till 12, 1 o'clock at night just cutting rawhide that she flesh herself, you know, and we never cut rawhide before, and we had quite a lot of fun doing it, though.
What happened?
Well, we cut them, and I was good at cutting all right, but I cut it off, and then we'd have to splice them together, because if we didn't splice them together and kept on cutting, it would be a terrible mess to string them out. To dry, you know. They have to be all one length. I cut 3 strands at a time.
Have you seen rawhide before?
Mm-hmm. Then after a while we got pretty good with it, you know. And I cut lots of rawhide in my time, different size for our own use and some for sale. That time rawhide was about $3-4 a pound, but now I think it's about $30 a pound for rawhide.
Yeah.
Do you still cut it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We cut some here this summer. Oh. Mm-hmm. This spring.
So what are you going to use that for?
We use it. We put it away. It's down home in the cache, and we have plenty of rawhide there. Different size, small rawhide to work with. My built sleigh for my daughter. And you can do good work with small rawhide, and the bigger rawhide are for snowshoe footing.
Well, do you cut the rawhide the same way now, three pieces at a time,
or oh yes,
slicing it?
Yes, three pieces at a time. We start from in the middle of the moose skin and go round and round and round, work out towards the edge of the moose skin.
Did you ever make rawhide out of caribou skin?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. They make the best rawhide for snowshoe babish. Filling.
Babish?
Mm. Babish, yeah.
So what was that like when you're making your first pair of snowshoes and you didn't quite know what you're supposed to do with it?
What did you say?
What was that like when you were making that first pair of snowshoes?
I knew exactly how a snowshoe looks and how it's supposed to be, you know. I wore lots of them, you know. But they were made by other people, and I think we had a pair of snowshoes that I was looking at when I made the snowshoes. Yeah, I think
yeah,
I did.
Yeah. That's when I copied to fill up this.
Yeah.
And pair you made. Mm-hmm. Goof up there something along the way and then have to undo it again.
Yeah, there's not very many people make snowshoes, but at that time we all had to almost make our own snowshoes.
Well, how did you find the kind of birch you wanted the first time?
Well, I knew how to get good birch because I've seen older people. I used to go out with some older people and pack birch out of the woods for them, and I used to see how they pick their birch. They go along and look for a straight one that's got no limbs on it and certain size, say about 6-inch diameter, or if it's straight grain, they chop into it a little if it's warm weather and then pull the bark out, and they can see the grain is go straight down, then they know it's straight grain birch.
So did you have
to? And then there is a way to split that. You have to be very careful how you split it. You have to use axe, and you make a little maul out of a mallet or whatever you would call it, out of a birch stick, and you put the axe on the birch like this, and you hit that axe and make mark all along the birch in the middle. Go along and straight down on the ends, and same way on the other side, and keep on tapping it all along, and then both sides the same way. Then it'll just split exactly right down the middle. Then you can quarter it, the birch, and use the outside of the birch for snowshoes, and the middle part is all waste, because I don't know what they call that middle part. It's the heart, or it's generally kind of rough, but the outside birch is smooth.
So do you still split your birch when you make sleds and snowshoes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But nowadays we look for a good birch, and I just use a chainsaw.
Use a chainsaw to...
To split them.
To split it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very good, though.
saws it up pretty rough, but after I split the birch with the saw, the whip saw, the birch right down the middle with the chainsaw, then I, of course, you have to plane it, you know.
Is it as strong doing it that way? Birch?
Yeah, I don't believe in rip sawing birch up for sled making or something like that, unless it's really straight grain, because when you're sawing, you cut the grain, and a lot of times when you see the birch split on a sled, it splits right crossways almost. But when you pick out good birch and it splits on the sled, like on the side rail or something, it'll split almost the whole length of the way. Mm-hmm. Always pick birch with no knots in it, you know. A little knot on the outside of a birch will go clean through. A lot of people think that little knot is just on the outside, but it goes clean through the birch, to the middle anyway. But I'm no expert to working on birch or anything like that, but I know how to pick out good birch and to make sleds and things. I've made a lot of sleds, but I got a habit of making heavier dog sleds, like for hauling things and stuff like that. But when it comes to making a small racing sled, it's pretty hard for me to build a small racing sled because I'm not used to it. A racing sled has to be very light and fine work being done on it.
So you usually made working sleds?
And yes. Sleds? Yes. 10, 12 feet long sleds. And I think, even I say so myself, I've made about the easiest running sleds that I ever handled. And I've handled a lot of sleds, dog sleds in my time.
What makes yours easy handling?
Flexible. They're limber.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Is it the wood or how you design it?
Yeah, it's the it's the turn up, and the cross pieces are not too high, and then the side rails are not too thick, and it's long and more flexible.
You don't fit them in too tight, like most people do.
Well, they can be fit in tight and still be limber, you know, is what I mean.
I don't know. I don't know how it is. Did you start making, the first sleds you made were like that, or did you figure that out after you made a few?
After I made two or three sleds. I've used some sleds belong to other people, you know, and I learned from them. The old timers, natives on the trap line, they've had sleds, just very limber going through the woods with a load, and they claim they run much easier than a stiff sled. A stiff sled is only good for snow goes, and a dog sled is supposed to be limber.
Well, you know, when you learn how to make things, did you mostly learn from watching people, or did you ever ask questions? Did people ever explain words? Or
I was too bashful to ask people because a lot of people didn't like to be asked how they make their sleds, you know. And I learned from other people making sleds. My father-in-law, I learned quite a bit from him how to work on birch.
Well, you know, you've mentioned Lorraine's parents and her grandparents. Maybe you could say a little bit about them, what their names were, and, you know, where Lorraine was living, where they grew up.
Well, my father-in-law was Freddie Olin, and his father was a Frenchman, I believe, and he was a half-breed, my father-in-law was. And my mother-in-law was a native. So my wife must be quarter breed. And my wife's grandmother was very old when she died. Eva Roberts, her name was. I don't know how old she was when she died. She died
close to her 90s.
Yeah, close to 90 years old. And my wife's great-grandmother was almost 100, I guess.
What was her name?
Mrs. Esau is all I could.
That's all I know.
Yeah.
I know her Indian name.
What's her Indian name?
Well, gee, it's hard to say. Oh, you bought Adishna. That's hard.
Mm-hmm. I can't say it. So where did they live? Where did her great-grandmother live and her...
Cochrane's. We lived up in Cochrane's. It was quite a village then. I think when I was a kid, I counted houses there. There must have been 20-some houses.
25.
About 25 houses.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there was, in a lot of those houses, there were two families living in them.
Not big,
not
houses.
Not big families. The house was not very big.
Mm-hmm. What else was in Cochrane's then?
Well, there was a store, post office, and a school.
What kind of school was that?
Public school.
It was territorial school at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Who owned the store there?
Let me see. Was
the first storekeeper there was Omine Cochrane.
Yeah, and then
the only person who put up store there, first person.
That was Omine Cochrane.
Yes.
And Thompson.
And Omine Thompson. And then after that was Devane, I think.
Devane.
Tom Devane.
Yeah.
Mm. Thompson didn't sell it to Tom Devane, I don't think.
Well, what Thompson done with it, I don't know.
I thought there was somebody that run the store there.
Abe Collins?
Oh, that's way after. My stepfather run a store there for Tom Devane when Tom Devane bought the store, but I just don't remember who owned it. I think it was Thompson.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I was going to school there, I was about 11 years old, and I hear all the other kids say, Thompson talk about Thompson quite a bit, you know, in the store.
What was that like going to school? You said you went about 5 years?
Yes.
What kind of things did you learn in school? What did you do?
Oh, I learned how to read and write and a little history, arithmetic. That's about all.
What did you like best about school?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't like to go to school. There were so many things I'd like to do outdoors. I used to work pretty hard outdoors. But I had to go to school. And I guess that's... I went to school every winter for 5 years.
Who made you go to school?
Well, till my stepfather and was married to my half-sister, and they adopted me when I was 1 year old, and they separated when I was about 12. So I had no choice. I had no place to go to school. I had no place to stay. And I just made my living and worked since I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I stayed with one white man across Ruby when I was 13 years old, and I helped him cut about 30 cords of wood. Wood was $6 a cord. And then I trapped with another white man, a big creek out from Ruby. And I had a terrible time. I caught a couple of link, and link was pretty good price. And I didn't use much grub. Grub was cheap. And at that time, the natives were quite a few living around. And at that time, the natives used to all feed one another and everything like that. And it was kind of hard for a native to get stuck at any time. They were helping one another, you know.
Mm-hmm. So how would that work out to help one another? If somebody catches something, then... they would bring it back to the village? Is that how they do it?
Oh, yeah. They all, when they got a moose or anything, they all shared it with one another, or even fish and things like that. And like if some family, native family, was building a cabin or something, why, there's a lot of town boys would all help and... all helping one another.
Well, what would they do if there was just somebody who didn't want to work at all? Would people help them anyway?
Well, there was quite a few like that, but I don't know, they got by some way.
And the villagers used to...
collect money, collect
food for them.
Food around town, a little food from every house. Everybody would donate a little flour, a couple of cups of sugar, and whatever.
Whatever they could spare.
Yeah.
Some people really...
I've seen that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of that went on at home, cock rice.
Guess that was good, because sometimes you just got stuck, huh?
Mm-hmm. Especially in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Would people try to pay back some way? Would there be certain things people would do if they were helped out?
No, they're just what you call. I don't know. They were just no good people. But
they didn't care to work, and even they had kids.
We just gotta keep
but the
reading.
People felt sorry for them and just helped them out that way.
Do people still do that same kind of thing now?
No way.
No, no.
I look for money nowadays.
My boy. There's too much food stamps and welfare now.
Well, you know, when we're talking about Lorraine's parents and grandparents, her grandfather, what's his name, Olin?
Mm-hmm.
He was a Frenchman. What was he doing around Cochrane's?
I think, I just don't know. I know he trapped around there, or he was working on the boat or something.
Did he ever do gold mining?
He lived there, but I don't know what he was doing. He must have trapped.
They got that helicopter in the boat.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
They're landing?
Yeah.
Whole bunch landing to stay overnight, or they'll keep on going probably.
Yeah, it's not too dark.
Harold Smalka and Eddie Hildebrand and those people.
Oh, is that the helicopter that crashed?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even know it till they come by today.
They stopped?
Yeah.
Gee, we just want to make a light, huh?
Yeah, it's nice. Did you want to... I don't know. I really don't know much about him.
Yeah. Pretty old, and that's your dad, huh?
My father's... my grandfather's name was Lamonte. But my grandmother married again to Olin.
Oh. When we came down, we stopped at Cochran's.
Uh-huh.
Look around a little bit. And we stopped there in the cemetery at the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw Freddie Olin grave.
Well, that's my brother, that's Junior.
Oh, that was Junior.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We saw something else there too that I wanted to ask about. I walked through the woods and back over towards Cochran's from the cemetery.
Yeah.
And found this great big metal cauldron thing like that.
It's a
round pressure.
Yeah.
Kettle.
Kettle, right. Yeah.
Mm. I used to work in the ranger camp out there. They used to have that by us. A corral where we used to drive the reindeer. Slaughter reindeer.
Right back over, right around where you have you saw that pot. Uh-huh. Kettle.
Uh-huh.
That's a reindeer corral used to be.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was going to breed that for a souvenir.
I was pretty small at that time.
It's cracked.
Yeah, it's cracked. Yeah. I bet you did well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kids was going to bring it home for dog pot.
Yeah, there was four of us there this spring there looking at it. I was going to pack it out, but it was cracked, so I couldn't let it go.
The other thing, too, is that's Stanford or something?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Kurt, we're just trying to figure out what that was.
That's it.
That was just for a big water
kettle. Oh.
Oh, that's a... Boy, I don't know. That's a pretty old kettle, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cast iron.
Giant, too.
Now well, that's an antique. You were talking about is. Antique.
I don't know how the heck I found it. I was looking for it and I couldn't find it.
That was in 19 what, Dad? I was pretty small. I hardly remember, yeah.
Well, I was born in 1911. And I was 13 years old when I worked there. That was in 1924 or 25, I think.
No wonder I couldn't remember. I was born 1920. Must have been about 5 or 6 years old.
Well, who owned those reindeer?
Oh.
Cap William?
Cap William owned them. the Laplanders brought them in there from Nome, and there was two or three people that owned it, and then Cap William got to own it, and there was about 4,000 reindeer there. And then in 1924, I wasn't working there. I was about 13 years old when I worked there. Worked for $1.50 a day. We used to, the ranger, their home camp was out there at Malozzi Hot Springs. That's 15 miles inland from the Yukon. And there were no roads out there. We had to pack our own things out there. And they had sled deers, they call them reindeers. They, one reindeer hooked onto a sled, and they have to lead them in the winter time to haul this. One reindeer would haul, I just don't know how much, about 150 pounds without it, no problem. All tied behind each other, you know, seven or eight of them. They got their winter supply in. All their food and things in, mostly in the winter time. And I think they used to have a warehouse there. The warehouse belonged to the store, and then they owned a small warehouse too where they kept their things. Then in the summertime, we used to pack odds and ends out there. Pack for 15 miles in one day. Not too big of packs, but we didn't have no pack boards either. I didn't see no pack boards.
They had like dogs they have too, isn't it, that could pack?
No, they were reindeer dogs, reindeer herd dogs. Didn't pack nothing, they were small collies. They were smart dogs. They had about eight of them out there. Really friendly, and there was reindeer dogs, we called them. Like the sheepherders have, I guess. And we used these dogs to rounding up reindeer and everything.
Well, what would he use those reindeers for to make money?
Well,
would he do that?
Out there, the herd was out there, and then they had a big corral out there where we round up in the fall time. In August, we'd round up. And these, get them into this big, really a big corral, goodness sake. And all handmade with fence around with poles and there's, I don't know what you call it, pockets on the side with the door through there. And I don't know how we done it. We get them to milling and one person stand at this door and let only certain ones go through this door out into another corral. And just open the door, I remember, yeah, and close it when the too many try to go in. And there's certain ones, all the bulls, we used to, they used to castrate them, and there were steers. Then the fat ones we drive into Cochrane's in September by this time, little. Yeah, by this time, so all the meat can get on the last boat coming up the river. I think we drive in about 300. I often wonder, 300 reindeer every year. I don't know how they made enough money with that. course, they weren't paying us very much. Some of them, my uncle there was getting $2.50 a day, Deaf Mike, and the rest of them were getting $2 a day, and me, I was getting $1.50 a day.
So they just put those reindeer on, they're still alive, and they chip them out?
We drove them, herd them into Cochrane's, and there was a big krill there. Mm-hmm. We drive them in this krill, and then, okay, then the slaughter.
How you kill them?
One man in the krill with a .22 special, and shoot them.
In the head?
Yeah, shoot them in the head.